Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida.
Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined as always by Gatehouse Florida Capitol correspondent John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hello, Zach.
First, a quick programming note. The technology gods have not been shining on us today, so if things sound a little wonky, please bear with us. Hopefully, we'll have everything fixed by next week.
Well, Hurricane Dorian never made landfall in Florida, but the storm continues to reverberate in state politics, particularly when it comes to helping the people of the Bahamas. Meanwhile, Congress and the Florida legislature are returning to their respective capitals to work on legislation, and a pair of Florida universities are moving up in the rankings. We'll talk about all that, but first, you all know what that music means. It's time for Pick a Number. Remember these numbers, folks. Write them down because we'll be returning to them at the end of the show to tell you what they mean for Florida politics. John, did you come loaded with a number today?
I sure did, Zach. I'm treading into the decimal place turf again this week with my number, and that's 289.3.
Very precise. All right, I'm gonna go with a 70 for Zach Anderson and 289.3 for John Kennedy. And again, we'll come back to those numbers at the end of the show. Well, last I heard, Hurricane Dorian was dissipating somewhere in the North Atlantic last week after terrorizing much of the East Coast. Real terror was inflicted on the northern Bahamas, which was mauled by Dorian's Category 5 winds for the better part of the Labor Day weekend. Since the storm, the people of the Bahamas have been pleading for help, and many Florida leaders have rushed to offer assistance. After all, part of the Bahamas is only about 50 miles from South Florida, and there's a significant number of people in the state who have family ties to that island nation. Many Democrats, along with Republican U.S. Senators and Marco Rubio, have called on President Donald Trump to waive certain visa requirements for those traveling from the Bahamas so it's easier for them to get to the United States. But Governor Ron DeSantis has been more cautious. He has not taken a position on the visa waivers, saying that it is a federal issue. Those comments raise some eyebrows because other Republican leaders have been outspoken about the visa waivers, and because Rick Scott, when he was governor, was very aggressive about offering help to Puerto Rico when that island was hit by Hurricane Maria in 2017. Since DeSantis made those comments on Monday, he has made efforts to tout all the aid that Florida is helping to deliver to the Bahamas, but he seems concerned about appearing to sort of open the floodgates to Bahamians relocating to Florida, even on a temporary basis. John, what's your read on how DeSantis is approaching this issue? Is this good policy, good politics? What do you think?
Well, it seems that DeSantis is trying to do something of a balancing act, and immigration policy may be at the heart of his reaction. Clearly, there's a humanitarian aid needed in the Bahamas, and Florida is the closest neighbor to the nation, and there's a sizable Bahamian community in South Florida that has tried to reach out. But DeSantis has pretty much kept quiet when Senators Rubio and Scott were calling on the Trump administration to put out the welcome mat for people that want to relocate to Florida from the Bahamas. And, you know, sure enough, DeSantis's mentor, President Trump, now says he's not going to allow temporary protected status for Bahamians. That's what Rubio and Scott wanted. Instead, Trump has been saying that just outside the White House earlier this week, he said that he didn't want to allow people that weren't supposed to be in the Bahamas to come into the U.S., saying that this is a great Trumpian quote, some very bad people and some very bad gang members could gain entry. That's what his fear seems to be. Of course, he did not amplify on this statement, but that's basically where we stand now. Meanwhile, DeSantis this week got kind of testy when asked if Florida was doing all it could. He turned it around. He said this is a federal responsibility, and he didn't like the suggestion that Florida wasn't doing enough. Here's his response.
It should be the state's responsibility. If you think that, then you have no idea how our system of government works. I've been in contact with them. The idea that I would overstep the State Department is just absurd.
And he also tried to explain the White House rationalization, no reference to Trump's very bad people. But DeSantis pointed out that this country, and yes, the leaders in the Bahamas, too, that they want to keep people there. Here's what he said about that.
Visas now, but I mean, look, I want to, the president, I think, is working with the Bahamian government. But I think the main thing they're trying to do is keep people in the Bahamas and bring them to safety, because most of the Bahamas was not affected by this.
So then a couple of days later, he seemed to shift some, deciding that it was important to highlight the amount of resources that the state was sending to the Bahamas, not just pointing to leftover state hurricane supplies, like several truckloads of bottled and canned water that he was sending from the state's emergency management division. But he also pointed out that private citizens and companies are also leading an effort. Even the state House Republicans are putting up $100,000 for the relief effort. And a former ambassador to the Bahamas, John Rood, he's a DeSantis donor from Jacksonville. He's leading efforts to build transitional housing for people in the Abacos. Now, here's the governor outside Florida Power and Light's Hurricane Command Center, where DeSantis finally put a price tag on the state's aid.
The total amount that's either been given or pledged right now in Florida to Bahama relief is over $11 million. And so that's a really shows you how Floridians respond to things. And yes, part of it is we do have a good relationship with the Bahamas, but part of it is that I think that's just how people are and they want to be able to help.
But you know, all told, you can't help think that the response to the Bahamas is somewhat shaded by a president facing re-election and certainly not wanting to appear that he's softening his commitment to border security and not letting undocumented or even temporarily documented immigrants into this country. And Florida's governor certainly me too's that approach. And, we've spoken pretty regularly on this earlier versions of Inside Florida Politics here about how DeSantis signed into law Florida's sanctuary cities ban. That's a direct order for local law enforcement to assist federal officials with enforcing immigration laws. So while Senators Rubio and Scott seem to see the need for temporary protected status for Bahamians, Trump and DeSantis basically say no. It's an interesting schism among some, very conservative Republicans.
Yeah, and DeSantis has gotten pretty good reviews for his handling of the storm. He seemed calm. He seemed patient. He didn't overreact. He didn't force or encourage a lot of evacuations that ended up not being necessary when the storm that turn, but he seems a little bit less sure-footed when it comes to this issue of these Bahamians who need help. It seems like he's kind of caught between this Trump position to try and limit immigration, and I don't quite understand that, John, because these people aren't necessarily immigrating to the United States. I mean, temporary protected status is one thing. It would allow them, yes, to live here for a while and work. But what about the visa waiver thing? I mean, visa waivers is just, you don't have to go through quite as much bureaucracy to come to the U.S. for a little while you're trying to get back on your feet. It's not like an immigration status. Any thoughts on his reluctance to even take a position on that?
Yeah, I think he's just very cautious about getting out in front of the White House on this somehow, that whatever he said that looks like, it could be considered conciliatory toward the Bahamas, that it might contradict what the, President Trump's view of this is. So I think DeSantis is, trying to just tout the vast amount of resources that the state has been trying to pour toward the Bahamas. But, every day it seems like there's some story of Bahamians being denied admission to this country or literally being taken off airplanes because they don't have the proper visa to come over to the country, or that the immigration folks in the U.S. are now asking for documentation from these Bahamians that they just can't provide. I mean, a lot of these people are coming out of, wrecked homes. We've had experiences of that very commonly in Florida, recently last year with the panhandle. So, what that's like. So it's a real mess in the Bahamas. It's not getting any better right now.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that there is almost no daylight between Rick Scott and Donald Trump on any including immigration. And yet he's willing to be out in front on trying to get temporary protected status and visa waivers for these Bahamians. It's something that, he has a history of with trying to help Puerto Rico, even though Trump has said some derogatory things about Puerto Rico. Scott has seemed to think that these are our neighbors and they have close ties to Florida. We're going to help them. And, it probably has helped him politically as well. Catering to the Puerto Rican vote may have helped him win a very, very close U.S. Senate race. So it's kind of fascinating to see DeSantis taking a more cautious approach. I don't necessarily see the political downside to him, being more aggressive on this. But I guess we'll see how it plays out. We'll watch and see how DeSantis continues to approach this issue. At the federal level, there could be some action in Congress to urge Trump to do more for the Bahamas now that lawmakers are back in session. But Congress also has a lot of other issues to grapple with right now. I attended a town hall meeting last week that was hosted by Congressman Vern Buchanan, who is a Republican from over here in Southwest Florida. Buchanan said he wanted to get input from his constituents before he headed back to D.C. His district leans Republican, but this town hall was a mixed crowd that include plenty of people in MAGA hats and also plenty of folks wearing climate change buttons and ACLU buttons and gun control T-shirts. And interesting enough, the number one issue that people raised was gun violence. Earlier this month, there was another mass shooting in Texas, which followed the mass shooting last month in El Paso, Texas, in Dayton, Ohio. A number of audience members told Buchanan they are fed up with this gun violence.
I'm tired of Parkland. I'm tired of Sandy Hook. I'm tired of El Paso. I was just in Orlando with a group of us, and the bus stopped, and I looked, and we were outside the Pulse Bank. All of this has got to stop. I mean, it's too much. Enough is enough. We need extreme risk orders. We need a ban on assault weapons.
So there you heard the applause when she said we need a ban on assault weapons. Now, Buchanan is not the typical Republican House member when it comes to guns. He was one of just 8 GOP members of Congress who voted universal background check bill earlier this year. Here's Buchanan's response to that audience member.
And I agree with you. There's too much violence. That's why I was 1 of 8, someone mentioned, in terms of background checks. There's other things we need to do. So I hear what you're saying.
So Buchanan is kind of an outlier among Republicans. He has really been out front in saying that this gun violence is gotten way out of hand. And, he's touting his support for background checks and red flag laws. As Congress reconvenes, the gun issue is going to be in the spotlight again. But folks like Buchanan probably won't have much of a say over it. The House has already passed legislation, and it's really up to Senate leader Mitch McConnell and President Donald Trump to decide whether they'll do anything on this. Polls show there is overwhelming public support for additional gun control measures, but there's also a strong contingent within the GOP base that would view new gun restrictions as a major betrayal. And political observers know that Trump is reluctant to do anything to cross his base. So it's a big question mark as to whether there's any action on guns at the federal level. Meanwhile, the Florida legislature will start holding committee meetings again next week, and guns will also be a topic of discussion. And unlike Congress, the legislature has actually passed some modest but meaningful gun control measures in recent years. John, tell us what's happening in the legislature with guns and where you see this going.
Well, the legislature returns to the Capitol Monday for the first of several committee weeks before the 2020 session, which starts in January. And Senate President Bill Galvano, a Bradenton Republican, he's ordered one of the Senate committees to begin examining the causes behind mass shootings. He says he wants an open discussion, everything on the table. And the lineup for Monday's hearing has academics, law enforcement, mental health professionals, and others representing prosecutors in the criminal justice system. It looks like this first hearing is going to be, you know, pretty much at the 20,000 foot level, maybe steering clear of any legislative proposals. But Democrats clearly want to discuss enhanced background checks and expanding red flag laws that allow law enforcement to remove guns from the homes of troubled individuals. And doubtlessly, there's going to be some talk of limits on assault style weapons. But hard to say, though, just, you know, how far this Republican-controlled committee will go at its opening round, and the future of anything coming out of the Senate. You know, that also has to be tempered by the fact that the more conservative Florida House, well, it is not joined in Galvano's call for action at all. The House's week of committees has no hearing like the one set for the Senate. So, you know, I think that's a message from the House that maybe they are not that interested in advancing anything that would, you know, touch on looking like it could be restrictions on weapons or expanding law enforcement oversight of those who can obtain weapons in Florida.
Yeah, color me skeptical that much will come out of this latest round of committee hearings and inquiry into gun violence. I think that you know, the changes that we saw were really you know, a visceral response in some ways to the Parkland shooting, which was absolutely devastating when you have kids getting killed in their schools. And I feel like the legislature probably felt like they had to respond to some degree. But the farther we get away from that, I think it becomes less likely that you see gun control happening at the state level in Florida. There is a constitutional amendment push that would ban assault weapons. They're trying to get that measure on the ballot in 2020, and it has been raising a significant amount of money and gathering signatures. So we'll see where that goes. But on this issue, that seems like probably the most likely venue for much happening. Well, we've talked about gun violence. We've talked about people being devastated by a hurricane. We're going to turn now to some news that's a little more cheerful, more positive, and that's some university rankings that came out this week. The University of Florida was ranked number 7. Florida State University was ranked number 18 for public universities. Governor Ron DeSantis was quick to tout the new rankings, and lawmakers lavished praise on the schools. But anyone who follows Florida politics knows that universities have been in the crosshairs in Tallahassee in recent years. House leaders have really gone after the university system and raised questions about inappropriate spending. John, do you think these new rankings will ease some of the pressure that university leaders have faced in recent years?
Well, I think the news has several layers of good about it for Florida universities, and you know, even maybe for schools not named Florida State or the University of Florida, maybe they're going to get helped by it too. As you pointed out, for the last couple of years, universities have been on the hot seat in Tallahassee. In 2017, then House Speaker Richard Corcoran, who is now the state's education commissioner under Governor DeSantis, he went after the state public universities for creating foundations that have swelled with money, and that often gets used to help support lavish trips, pay lobbyists, and support high salaries paid to top educators and administrators. Corcoran tried to rein in this spending, or at least put fear into the universities about that practice. They're trying to get them to curtail some of the what he saw as the excesses of these foundations. And last year, we went through it again. Well, earlier this year in the legislative session that ended in May, the House also attempted to cut university spending. Representative Randy Fine from Brevard County, he drew attention for talking about closing the University of Central Florida as punishment for misusing $38 million to in which the university constructed a new building by using money that was supposed to go to instruction, research, and other programs. The House also wanted to cut off what's called preeminence money. That's extra cash for programs which go to University of Florida, Florida State, and the University of South Florida. They at least wanted to reduce the amount of preeminence money. This is sort of performance-based funding that gives these top universities an extra boost. Well, now what's being identified as a reason for the gains by UF and FSU, more state funding. the tens of millions of dollars in extra money that are poured into these campuses that allow them to lower class size and enhance programs and do other good things. So, you know, you got to wonder, you know, will this be the end of the criticism of university spending when you get these rankings that seem to support the idea of more money? Well, probably not. The preeminence money that UCF is trying to get the designation, and so too is Miami's Florida International University, that preeminence money gets dinged sometimes by critics who say it disadvantages smaller schools and those serving large minority or low-income communities. And there will probably be a continuing push for some kind of broader distribution of this preeminence cash from the legislature. So, you know, I don't think the fight over university funding is ending, but it certainly seems to support that perhaps, you know, more money is better for these universities. You know, the overall lesson maybe is, you know, you get what you pay for in Florida public universities.
Yeah, it certainly gives the universities a big talking point as they go into negotiations with the legislature over their funding. I mean, this funding that they've given, this supplemental funding, preeminence funding, well, they've proven that they're preeminent universities. When the University of Florida is in the top 10 of public universities and Florida State University is in the top 20 for the first time, it seems like they're doing something right. It seems like they are achieving a level of preeminence. So they're going to have a pretty good case to make that the legislature, you know, was wise in investing in these schools. And I think that, you know, you might see a little bit less pressure on them going forward, but we'll have to wait and see. The legislative session is coming up in January, so we'll know then. Well, we're going to move on to our final pick a number segment. I'll go first this week. My number is 70. That's the number of state lawmakers who are millionaires. There are 160 members of the Florida legislature, so about 44% are millionaires, or nearly half of the legislature. The wealthiest state lawmaker is Senator Jordan, who is worth $46 million. He owns auto dealerships in the Panama City area. An interesting comparison, Governor Ron DeSantis is relatively low on the list of lawmakers when it comes to net worth. His total net worth is just $283,605. That's a big difference from the last governor, Rick Scott, who was worth hundreds of millions. Scott spent tens of millions of his own money to win two races for governor in a U.S. Senate race. DeSantis doesn't have that luxury, so we'll see whether that impacts his electoral prospects going forward. He won the closest governor's race, and he'll have to try and do it again in 2020, but this time he is a sitting governor, which is a big advantage when it comes to raising money. Well, John, close it out here with 289.3. What does that mean?
Zach, that $289.3 is $1 million, and that's what state economists are projecting will be Florida's cash surplus when the legislature begins building next year's spending plan, which will top this year's almost $91 billion budget. That's not bad. It represents what's left over after the state meets what these analysts say are the state's high priority and critical needs. What it doesn't leave a lot of money for are the special programs and projects that legislators like to get funding for, a lot of times to, you know, help out their own district. But all told, the money's not super tight in the three-year budget outlook that the legislature will formally adopt this week, a requirement under the state constitution. What does get kind of skimpy, though, are the next two spending years, where shortfalls of almost $500 million and almost $400 million are expected, respectively, over those 2 years. So the message to legislators is to start reducing program growth and make cuts in the coming year to keep these shortfalls away. That's the message coming from Senate President Bill Galvano and, you know, implicitly from the economists who make this presentation to lawmakers. This is the kind of, it's kind of a traditional pattern where these annual budget outlooks are forecast. The economists offer an eat your peas approach, and legislative leaders tend to embrace this austerity. But what it really does is it gives these leaders a political tool, too. It gives House Speaker Jose Oliva and Senate President Bill Galvano and their budget chiefs power to pick and choose what to spend money on, telling members, you know, sometimes even from their own party, that we can't afford what they want. But, you know, when it comes to leadership, the leaders can afford what the leaders determine to be the priorities. So tight money can be a good political tool for those at the top.
Yeah, always good to have a surplus, no matter how modest it is. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Joseph Borzano, Thomas Cordy, and Adam Fish. And thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.